Now playing in Los Angeles, exquisite food and drink, world-class art everywhere, spectacular sports, dazzling Hollywood attractions. L.A. offers the full variety of food scene, from game-changing taco trucks to 35 Michelin stars. And did you know that Los Angeles has more museums and theaters than New York City? Get your fix in music, film, comedy, and world-class museums. Plus, get behind the scenes in movie magic with a world-famous studio tour. That's something that should be on everyone's bucket list. Start here with discoverla.com. When you hear that Mint Mobile wireless plans are $15 a month when you purchase a three-month plan, you're probably thinking, what's the catch? Well, there isn't one. Mint Mobile is here to rescue you with premium wireless plans for just $15 a month. Say bye-bye to your overpriced wireless plans, jaw-dropping monthly bills, and unexpected overages. All plans come with unlimited talk and text and high-speed data delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. You can use your own phone with any Mint Mobile plan and bring your phone number along with all your existing contacts. Our producer, Sean, is a big Mint Mobile guy. Here's what he had to say.
For a fraction of the cost, Mint Mobile proved to have excellent coverage with no drop calls or unsent texts. Plus, they make it super easy for me to activate my device just by following a few simple steps online. And bam, done. It was great.
To get this new customer offer and your new three-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/literally. That's mintmobile.com/literally. And cut your wireless bills to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/literally. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first three-month plan only. Speeds slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
Hey, Peter.
How are you?
I'm good. I'm sporting the one of your many team colors
uniforms.
I love it. I usually record my introductions to my guests after they leave.
Great.
But you, I want you to sit here and take it.
No, don't do that.
Hey, everybody. You have found it. This is the podcast. This is what you were looking for, literally, with Rob Lowe. And my guest today is the legendary Hollywood figure, sports figure, businessman, producer, author, Peter Guber. I've known you for how many years now? For since 1983.
Yeah.
And I know, I've always wanted to have you on the show. I love you as a man and a person and all those things. But last night, I figured it was time to be professional, really, is what it was about. I figured, professional people. So I better
know some
have
people
my
that are masquerading as professional people, but they're not very professional.
Well, that's true. You've seen all shapes and sizes. So here, okay, you're the co-owner of four pro teams, including the Dodgers and the Golden State Warriors. You are a number one New York Times bestseller. I, sir, cannot claim that. I'm a New York Times bestseller, but never went to number one like you have. I read last night, which I recommend to anybody out there listening, to go and read your what you wrote for the Harvard Business Review, which is the four truths of the storyteller. See, I write for stupid things like Vanity Fair. You write for the Harvard Business Review. That's one of the many differences in the size of our brains. This is my favorite, though. The movies you have produced have earned $3 billion at the box office and have 50 Academy Award nominations. I'm just going to give you a little bit of a list. I'm sorry of turning this into This Is Your Life, but fuck it. I don't care. It's too good. All right. So you have been, and listen, you've been a studio head. You've run, so that means you literally have said, make this movie, don't make that movie. You've produced movies, which, as you know, means from the ground up working on them. But however you've been involved in them, the movie list is Shampoo, Taxi Driver, The Way We Were, A Few Good Men, Philadelphia, Sleepless in Seattle, A River Runs Through It, City Slickers, Basic Instinct. You produced Rain Man, Batman, Color Purple, Midnight Express, Missing, Flashdance. And then when you decided to dabble in television, there was that show Seinfeld. But more importantly than all of that, you produced Youngblood with me. How do you like that?
I do.
You know what? It's like Ty Cobb said, it ain't bragging if you've done it, dude. And you have done it. So I'm really, really thrilled to have you on the show.
But I got to put a big asterisk next to that. Because you know this, because you've been in show business your whole life. All right? Big asterisk. I did not do it. I participated in it. I helped it. I coerced it. I coached it. I ran the company, or I put the thing together, or I helped. In other words, these are all collaborative enterprises. To say that the word I did it, no, I was there, I helped it, I nurtured it, and being responsible as one of the people that were deeply involved in it, yes, but you cannot take singular credit for anything in showbiz.
Well, and that's the other thing that's great about you is you're so humble and so willing to spread the glory and the praise to others. And as you know, there are, you know, we got one in the White House. We get it's like me, I. But it's true. What we do is a collaborative art for sure. I mean, and I think people who aren't filmmakers or TV makers will be shocked to know that anywhere along the production line, someone can elevate it beyond measure or fuck it up immediately.
True.
Which do you think is harder for you? I'll ask you which is more interesting later, but which was harder, running, having to look at a script and going, yeah, I think this story about two estranged brothers, one of whom with severe mental disabilities, is a massive hit. By the way, it doesn't sound like it when you pitch Rain Man, but you greenlit it. Was it harder to greenlight movies and pick and choose what to make with your investors' money, or is it easier just to produce movies and climb, put them on your back and try to sell them?
Well, the last one, I put them on my back and tried to sell them. That was Rain Man. It was started out as a television script, a rough television script that Barry Morrow wrote, and we labored with it for nearly 5 years before we got to the Academy Awards. So the journey was long, arduous, and at all times uncertain, with many directors doing it, developing it, and then dropping out of it. Sidney Pollack did it for a while and dropped out of it. You know, Spielberg did it for a while and dropped out of it. And, you know, a lot of directors dropped in and out of it. So these projects are generally marathons as opposed to sprints. And so what you really say is, what's really harder? What takes more tenacity or skill or endurance? They all do at different times in different ways. And, you know, if I used to say this to people, because I don't remember, and I'm not attributing it to me. I heard it from somewhere, but I own this statement because it relates to what I do. If I made all the pictures I passed on and passed on all the pictures I made, I'd probably be still sitting here talking to you. So I'm not sure I could take any credit for anything.
That you think that's the batting average?
Yeah, well, you know, it's a funny thing. If you're in the game, a lot of stuff comes across your screen and you're picking and choosing and you're developing things, and some things work, some things don't work, and fate and circumstance shines on you. The movie God is very perverse, you know. Just when you think your life's over, they give you, you know, some film or some The Last Dance, they give you your last act, and they give you Youngblood in your first act. You know what I mean? So
yes.
You're not in charge, but you're in charge of how you react to it. So, you know, you have to have too much hubris to believe that, you know, thank you. I did this. I worked 10 years. Look what I did. And sit down. Those 15 seconds of the award, whether it's the Golden Globe, whether it's the Grammy, whether it's the Bear in Germany, whether it's the Donatello.
The César. I was talking about the César with Alec Baldwin. Right.
That 15 seconds for that piece of plastic or metal isn't what it's about. It's the journey. It really is the journey. It's what makes up you. It's what holds you together. It's the stuff that you look at and say, yep, I know what I went through to help get that produced, made, developed, the changes you do. And you have to take, that has to nurture you. It can't be the credit or the box office or reviews. It has to be your own internal engine that you march to, that you feel is fulfilled by the process. And I think, you know, that's what you do.
Do you feel like it's harder to make? Look, I'm just looking at some of the credits again. I mean, A River Runs Through It is not made as a movie today. No fucking way.
But that's a good story. That's a really good story. So I'm running.
It's a story about fishing.
No, but listen, that's what I'm going to tell you. So I'm running. Right. I'm running Sony.
Too much fishing in it.
No, but listen, it's a great story. Running Sony, the whole company, gigantic company, and I wasn't running the movie companies. That was John Dolge, and I wasn't running the studios at that time. There were two different studios with men running it and women running it. And I wasn't the head of production. There were people there. And we used to give the budgets out to each company and what they would do. And one day, this rascal comes running into my office and saying, Mark Canton says, we have to make this movie. We have no money in the budget. It's River Runs Through It. I said, River runs through what? And he says, the river. I said, but I don't make that decision. Go see them. He said, no, they don't want to make it. They won't make it. You're the boy. I'm saying, I don't do that anymore. He said, yes, you got to look at it. I said, what's it about? He says, fly fishing. I said, I'm going to choke you to death right now. I'm going to reach across this table and make sure you never can speak again to anybody. So you want us to make a picture about fly fishing? Fly fishing? Are you crazy? Fly fishing? And he came back time and time again. Then he brought Bob Redford back. Bob Redford was the director at that time. Doing it, he said, I want to make it, I'm making it. Now, when he brought Bob Redford back, he had me at hello. That was one of the problems, you know. There was like one of the
even with fly fishing. Even with fly fishing.
Well, here was the problem. He said, you don't have the money in the budget. I said, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll take $5 million, he needed $5 million more, out of the next year and give it to you this year, but you're going to pay for it next year. You're going to have less currency in your company. I'm going to tell the head of your studio and the head of production that. But man, you better catch a fish, man, for this. And he did, you know? So everybody makes decisions along in the process. That happened to be one of the seminal decisions that got that picture made with Sony. It might have been made with somebody else. Somebody else could be sitting here talking to you about that movie. You know, fate and circumstance play such a part in success and failure.
But by the way, I don't believe today, whoever's in your position at that company now, and that exact same thing happens, and somebody comes in with, who would it be? It was Redford then. Who? First of all, here's half the problem. Who would it be today?
Well, it might be Leonardo DiCaprio. Could be could be Matt Damon. Could be Christian Bale. There are some really fine superstar actors that still move the meter. I mean, nobody guarantees it like it was back then. More guarantee. But, you know, you're making you have to make, if you're in the movie business, you have to make movies. You have to greenlight them. You can't wait, you know, for what you think the perfect script is. I waited once for the perfect script. It was with Mike Nichols and Warren Beatty and Jack Nicholson and a whole thing.
Oh, those hacks. Forget those guys.
And
those
it was
hacks.
It was called, I can't remember what it was called, but it was a flop.
I know what it was called. Was it the Elaine May? Did Elaine May write it? Who wrote it?
Yeah, Elaine May, I think, wrote it. It was what they...
Aha!
It was two films, Shampoo and that film. Both were being greenlit at the same time for Warren Beatty. And, we picked the two. We said, we don't want to make the one about the hairdresser. We don't want to make that ridiculous film, the hairdresser. We want to make the other one with Mike Nichols. Well, we made them both, and Mike Nichols was the flop, and the hairdresser was Shampoo was the hit. Go figure.
If you'd have sat in a screening room, though, and seen both as a double feature before you released them, would you have known the difference?
Well, let me say, I would have probably been insecure as I was when I made the decision. I'm not sure. It's the old story. When can you tell it's a hit? You can tell it's a hit when the box office fills up. You know, just nobody really, really knows till the audience turns up. Because you wouldn't have. I think Shampoo was a unique picture with Hal Ashby directing and really, you know, well done. And Julie Christie and Warren Beatty. But Mike Nichols' picture with that cast and that director, holy moly, that was the gold standard. But you know, there are no sure things in baseball or in movies.
Now, and I look at movies like I look at things like, you know, by the way, Midnight Express, one of my favorite movies, doesn't get enough credit today. I mean, my memory of Midnight Express was it blew my mind. It's like Cuckoo's Nest. Like it's like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest for me, where a movie that is seminal formed like what it means to be an actor. What I remember being in the movie theater and it was so intense and all of those things. I'm not wrong in that, right? That my recollection of experiencing it as a 15-year-old boy is exactly as it was, correct?
A giant mother of a hit that nobody even suspected that I was a producer then, and Columbia didn't even want to, after they made the picture, didn't want to release it. They didn't even want to release it, so they decided they take it to France, to Cannes, where it could get buried, you know, in the mm-hmm. director's section. And it's like anything, it took off around them, and it made a big change. I remember when the government is going to prevent this film from coming out because it's pro-drug and this, and they're going to stop. I thought, okay, that's what's going to happen. Instead, the government said, this is the best anti-drug film we've ever made. We're going to play the music in all the customs halls for the next 3 years for everybody coming back into the country.
Man, if I was carrying a joint and they started playing that Giorgio Moroder theme, I would lose it.
Right.
Oh, my God. I mean, that movie made going through customs more frightening than swimming in the... I was way more frightened of going through customs than people were seeing Jaws and going in the water.
Right.
100%.
Right.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back.
Hey, listeners. Ever have trouble getting someone on the phone when you have a question about your credit card? With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day, or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Thanks to Quince, I can get high-end, versatile pieces at fantastic prices. They've got killer luxury essentials that are perfect for my wardrobe. Quince has all the must-haves, like Mongolian cashmere crewneck sweaters from $50, iconic 100% leather jackets, and versatile flow-knit activewear. The best part, all Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of middlemen and passes that savings on to us. And Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices, along with premium fabrics and finishes. One of my producers tried Quince, and here's what he had to say.
I'm really excited to revamp my closet with Quince. There are so many great options at pretty unbeatable prices. I'm really excited to try out the burgundy cashmere crewneck. I love the blue chore jacket. Maybe I'll throw some joggers in there. These are great options at pretty unbeatable prices.
Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/rob for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's Quince, quince.com/rob to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/rob.
Stay connected this winter with this unbeatable deal from Breezeline. Get reliable, fiber-powered internet for just $19.99 per month with all-in pricing for 2 years. But that's not all. Your first month is on us. This deal gets better with a free modem and installation, along with free Wi-Fi your way whole home coverage. Safeguard your network from cyber threats and keep all your devices connected and secured with this amazing offer. Act now. Terms and conditions apply. Offer expires March 3rd, 2024. Learn more at breezeline.com.
So it's funny that you said Rain Man was a TV series. I want to circle back to that for a minute. It was a TV series? Did I hear you right? You said
TV,
you just said
TV
that, right?
Movie of the week. TV movie of the week.
It's funny because how everything in life comes full circle. I had a meeting with a very famous producer about 2 years ago who wanted to work with me and do something in television, and he owned the TV rights to Rain Man. and I was like, and he's like, and you'll play the Tom Cruise part and blah, 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 blah. And I started thinking about it. I said, wait a minute, let's just walk this through to its logical conclusion. If it works as any form of a TV series, which is a big if, that means that whoever is playing the Dustin part is killing it.
Right.
Which means I will be sitting in the front row of every awards ceremony applauding him
right.
with a statue.
Right.
Am I wrong? Was that
you're
thinking exactly
right? 100%, 1,000,000,000% right. Absolutely right. I actually thought Tom Cruise should have been nominated and won the Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor. I thought he was great in that movie. Great.
He was great. He's great in it. And it's one of those parts that the movie doesn't work without Tom.
It doesn't.
I mean, Dustin's got the showy and crushes as he is wont to do, but that movie doesn't work without Tom, you know, supporting it. And I just, that's what 40 years of being in show business gives you, is that kind of perspective.
Totally.
Where I'm like,
yeah.
So if we
very
catch
smart
the hail-
decision. Yeah, they had you at what about, and you knew it didn't sound right.
What about? Here's, you know what was interesting is you also were involved with one of my favorite movies, American Werewolf in London. And I love that movie so much. And I was talking to Jason Blum, who does all of the great horror movies today. He's an amazing business. He's a really smart man. And he's crushed it, 100% crushed it. And I said, he wanted to do something. And we were trying to, I said, is there a version of a movie like American Werewolf in London to be done? Because it's been forever. It's another one of those movies that I think is underappreciated. And there are generations of people I don't think that are as familiar with it as they should be. And he was like, you can't make that movie today. So what do you mean? Because you can't make it. Cannot make it. Because I make horror for a living. I wouldn't know how to sell it because of that tone. And I thought, what a shame.
Yeah.
What a shame. But he's right. The scenes in American Werewolf in London where Griffin Dunne is decaying in the movie theater over and over and talking to McNaughton, it's hilarious and frightening. And they don't think they could do it today.
Films are most always live within the period they're made. Very, very few films, you know, transition into another era, another period, either the filmmaking or the narrative. I mean, you take a film like Godfather, you can still watch it today, a young audience still watch it and find it, you know, compelling and beautiful and interesting, but more reflective. It doesn't have the pacing or the tone of today's films. So it's a contemporary art form. And so you run that risk of films having that short lifespan, but powerful lifespan.
Well, then how do you avoid the old man yelling at the clouds meme? Like, then the days when we used to be able to take time to tell a story. Like, I don't find anything wrong with The Godfather's pacing. And yet, you're right. It wouldn't be made like today. Couldn't be made like that today. And you've been through all of it. And another one of the things I love about you is your perspective on life is that of somebody who's still in their 20s. Like, there's no notion coming from you that it was better at a former time. Clearly some things had to have been better. I'm not saying all of it, but it's so easy, even at my age, to look back and go, man, music today sucks. You want great music? I will pitch you 1979 to 1985. And go ahead, try and beat it. Go for it. And I never get that off you, ever. You're like, today is the best day that ever was. How do you do that?
Well, I have a motto. The past is history. The future's a mystery. The present's a gift. That's why they call it the present. So I try to live and do what I need to do today to feel fulfilled and positive and constructive in my life and participating with the tools and resources that the marketplace gives me. That's my dog barking. I got to tell him to shut up. Shut up! Okay. See, you got quiet. That's direction. That's the good director.
That's real power.
Right.
Another thing I didn't know this about you. Were you really a juror in the Winona Ryder shoplifting trial?
Yeah, that was an out-of-body experience, you know, and that was truly, I retreated to another place, you know, I retreated into a place where I couldn't believe it. But, you know, when you're asked the question by the main judge with the DA sitting there and just asked you one question when you were being reviewed of whether or not they got being on the trial, and I wanted to be off it no matter what. I didn't want to be in the jury, in any jury. He said, let me ask you something, Mr. Goober. I want to know this. Answer yes or no. Will you tell the truth? Will you give the truthful answer to your view? Now, I thought, I say, no, I won't. I look like the biggest dope in the planet. Yes, I will. That's going to mean my fate is sealed. I'm all right. I said, yes, I will. Of course, I'll always tell the truth. But he says, is there any reason that you shouldn't be on this jury? I said, I could list 35 of them. Will any of them change your mind? He said, no. I was cooked. So that was it. 2 weeks.
They did
2 weeks of listening to people and really getting a sense of what a jury's about, which said, I said, I'm never going to break the law to be in front of these 12 people. Never, 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 never. Because they, you know, they had all predispositions of what the person did and how he did it or she did it or what it was. And it wasn't no pretty television show, that's for sure.
Really? So yeah. Behind the scenes of a jury, it wasn't like 12 Angry Men.
It was like 12 angry people, because one of the jurors, male jurors, said, well, you know, she has to be guilty. She went in and bought two barrettes just before she took the stuff, supposedly, two barrettes for $25 a piece. So I said, sir, my daughters also bought barrettes at $25 a piece at stores. So would that make them guilty too? I mean, the whole idea that of the way people see and focus in these things is scary with a jury. You know, they bring their own predisposition, their anger, their drama to it. It was both boring and interesting at the same time. 2 weeks of it was too much. It should have been all done in an hour. You know what I mean? But it's what it is.
My dad is a lawyer in Ohio, trial lawyer, has been for over 55 years, and he just marvels in California. He said the average case in California would be one day.
Yeah.
In Ohio.
Crazy. It's crazy.
That's
crazy.
I also love your and then we got to get into sports at some point, but I love that you're so articulate and specific about the power of storytelling and its power beyond show business. I mean, obviously in show business, we have got nothing if we don't have stories, but you have a very fine way of talking about its power in the larger scope. And I agree with you. I would argue that storytelling might be the most powerful tool that man has. Don't you think?
Absolutely. If you really realize it, at the end of the day, people couldn't transmit or transform or move anything, any information across the population without narrative. You couldn't hold the information unless you had the context of narrative. You couldn't hold it. You couldn't remember it. The idea is, narrative gives the emotional base, the contextual base to information, which propels people to action. So the idea that you can have the skill, whether it's through voice or writing or just plain visual skill of telling your narrative, telling your story, is a totally empowering tool. And despots used it to great extent and have made careers and turned worlds around. And you know, poets have done it and magicians have done it with words and dialogue and gestures, all part of storytelling, because you want to move people to action. I use a word that I use for it that I think is that it's emotional transportation. It moves people emotionally. And when you move people emotionally, you capture them. You can't just give them information. It's resonant, memorable, and actionable when it is in a narrative form. And so teaching young people how to understand and decode information, decode story, and how to recode it so they can get people to collaborate and conform to laws and rules or work together in industries or businesses is a crucial humanistic tool. And without it, you're in deep trouble.
Do you think that storytelling has the same kind of people practicing it that it had in the past? I guess what I'm really asking is, is there any notion that storytelling is slightly a lost art or no?
No, I think that whether it's three lines on a television commercial or whether it's a speech by a political foe or somebody that you're in favor of, or whether it's editorial, I don't think anything could be lost from that importance of narrative. The idea that you can shape how you see something, you shape it with narrative. You shape it with what it means to you. How do you feel about it? That contextual reality is why we're alive. It is the sine qua non of our humanness. We do it in our religions. We do it in our faith bases. We do it in our social area. We do it in our political area. We do it in our sports area. You know, they won 4-2. That's a piece of information. You don't remember. They won 4-2 with two outs and two strikes and no balls in the ninth inning, and they won 4-2. How'd they do that? You know, so it has the ability to create curiosity in people. It has ability to be able to transform people's actions, to move them to action. So it's an art form that's not really taught really well because we learn it ad hoc from our parents when we're young, either to shut up and don't say anything or just give me the information. We learn it, you know, with all kinds of repercussions if we don't learn it well. But the real masters of it, whether they're despots or whether they're our heroes, have really been the archetypal people who have delivered narrative in success. And you'll see it in sports people, and you see it in movie people, you see it in television people, you see it in politicians, you see it in everybody, you see it in mothers and fathers. If a mother or father can narrate to their children with their stories, they can give them tools and resources and resourcefulness they can use all their life. Information is a cold comfort. It doesn't do much. It's only when it's wedded into a contextual reality of narrative that it provides propulsion, what I call emotional transportation, and moves people to action, to believe in something, to do something, to take action, to reconsider something. And without that, you don't got it. Well, you know, that's what I believe. I teach that. I think that's the most important thing. You know?
I'm so... Dude, I want to run through a motherfucking wall right now. It's got me so pumped.
Let me give you the sine qua non. Since you're a great actor, I want to tell you something. You hate me. Let's say you hate me. You just loathe and detest me. It's disgusting. You don't like what my life's about. You don't anything like that. Okay? Now, there's another me. You love me more than anything in the world. You're the greatest thing. You had great success with me, and they're all terrific. The hate me guy that you hate, the other guy, this other person, gives you a script, and the love you guy gives you a script. The hate guy gives you the guy you love gives you a script, and it's shit. I mean, from the first three sentences of the script, you go, oh, well, how could you even get it? It's just absolute shit. I love this guy. I love him, but it's crap. The guy you hate has just given you Lawrence of Arabia or The Godfather, and you hate the fucker. You know, just hate him, all right? You're going to find a way to do that script because you know what's on the page is the goal. And the other guy you love a lot, but you're going to have dinner with him, but you ain't going to do that movie. So that's the power of narrative. It speaks itself. There's a very important truth. Now, actors bring great value and performance and nuance and quality, but you can't put in what God left out. If you have a crappy script and you're in a play and you're the actor, make it a little better, but crap is still crap. And great, if it's great, you can make it even greater and better and give it nuance. So, those stories are an emotional currency that we all look for in our lives and in the writings that we choose to do in movies and television or in political framework. Look at the politicians that raise people to furor action, just crazy action with their stories and speeches. And look at the people that brought us great faith and hope and expectation with their political speeches. It's story. Here's what I used to say. If it ain't on the page, it ain't on the stage. And so show me the script and I'll show you the money.
We'll be right back after this.
Looking for a sparkling clean bathroom without so much hassle? Wet and Forget Weekly Shower Cleaner is here to revolutionize your cleaning future. Just spray today, rinse tomorrow, and voila! Enjoy a sparkling clean shower and tub without any scrubbing. It's the secret to a hassle-free clean bathroom that many are discovering. With over 33,000 five-star reviews, Wet and Forget Weekly Shower Cleaner has proven its effectiveness on shower glass, fixtures, tiles, and more, ensuring everything shines with minimal effort. This product has gained a loyal following thanks to its once-a-week application that makes it a standout in the cleaning aisle. Join the ranks of satisfied users who enjoy more me time and less clean time with Wet and Forget Weekly Shower Cleaner, available at Amazon, Lowe's, Menards, Home Depot, and Ace Hardware. It's the perfect choice for anyone wanting to simplify their cleaning routine. Don't miss out on a chance to transform your bathroom cleaning with just one application a week. Pick up a bottle of Wet and Forget Weekly Shower Cleaner today and join the thousands who've already made the switch to Effortless Clean.
Join Macy's in an effort to shop more sustainably with brands like Carter's Little Planet, Oak, On 34th, Elemis, and more. Plus, to help bring more parks to more people, Macy's is supporting Trust for Public Lands Community Schoolyards Project, transforming vacant schoolyards into green spaces to help ensure healthy, livable communities for generations to come. Donate online or in store and learn more at Macy's.com/purpose.
I love fast cars, but there aren't a ton of high performance EVs. They're certainly out here there. But when I get a chance to get behind the wheel of one, I love it. And I was blown away by the Kia EV6 GT. When you get behind the wheel of the Kia, it is literally like being in a state-of-the-art rocket ship, but also comfortable. The thing goes from 0 to 60 in 3.4 seconds. It is the premium driving experience. And of course, it's an EV. So the climate thanks you. SiriusXM provides access to over 165 channels in the vehicle. Music, sports, news, comedy, yacht rock. Let's go. Little Steely Dan going in your Kia. Come on now. So check it out today. It is the all-electric Kia EV6 GT. I had a blast checking it out. Believe me, you should do it yourself via kia.com/EV6 to learn more. That is kia.com/EV6. Kia, movement that inspires.
Do you have any recollection of where you were when you read a certain thing? You've seen so many great scripts. Like, I remember where I was when I read The West Wing for the first time. Does anything pop out to you where you go, holy shit, I remember turning the page and it was whatever? What project was that?
I was a producer before I ran Sony. And after I had run Columbia and after I run the other company, I was a producer for a number of years. And I was friendly with Marvin Hamlisch, mm-hmm. and different Broadway people, David Merrick and stuff. So I'd always go off Broadway to Pap Theaters and such. And I wanted to see this show that just was opening. Then no reviews. It was in workshop. And I asked, I had some clout by being in the business. I asked this producer, I said, can I get this show was sold out. It was like a 99th seat theater, or I don't remember what it was, 200 seat, it was a small theater in New York. I wanted to see it. And they set up a chair for me in the aisle, and I went and I saw it. And I was 10 minutes into it, and I couldn't sit still. I wanted to get over so I could try to buy the show. 10 minutes into it, I had seen something that was like, oh my God. By the time of the end, I had herpes on my head because I was sticking my arms around myself. I couldn't move. It was called A Few Good Men. And I looked at it. I said, we got to buy this. I went back to the studio. I said, you got to buy it. We got to buy it. We got to buy this. We bought the play. And later, when I became the head of the studio, Rob Reiner found it, made it into a movie. But when you read Aaron Sorkin, when you see somebody who can really put the magic of words and story and narrative together in such a way that you'd watch about a story about two guys in Guantanamo Bay and think you'd be compelled to it because it was really about something more than Guantanamo Bay. It's about something that was inherent in your life. You see that power of that narrative. It's so powerful. I couldn't sleep at night. I just had to figure a way to get that show.
God, it's so funny because when we were doing West Wing, that show made Aaron. Aaron wrote it when he was 24 years old.
Right.
Wrote it on the back of napkins as he was a bartender. And I never saw the play. It was famous. I remember hearing about it. And then the movie came out, and obviously the movie was huge. But when we were on West Wing, we would talk about the play, A Few Good Men, not the movie, the play. And there had only been a few people who'd ever played Caffey, Tom Cruise part. I think Tom Hulce, of all people, created it. I think Bradley Whitford did it for a while. And then Timothy Busfield. That's it. And every one of those guys would talk about how funny the play was and how many laughs there were in it. And I was like, I saw the movie. There weren't that many laughs in the movie, as good as it was. And then I got to do the play with Aaron. We went to London and we did it at the Haymarket. And that, and you're right, that play is so spectacular. Right. It is like a Swiss watch for the audience to it just works. It works like a finely calibrated watch. And you got to see the original. That's so cool.
Yeah, it's cool. And there's all stories all the way through. When the film came up, when I was running the studio with Rob Reiner, every piece of story there there's another unique piece of filmmaking lore and story, you know. A quick one, all right? Just a quick one?
Yeah, please.
So that movie was being made, and Rob Reiner, we were the owners of Castle Rock. Sony owned Castle Rock, 55% of Castle Rock, with Alan Horn and Rob Reiner and those guys.
Yep.
And Rob got a hold of the material out of Columbia's, because Columbia was the company working with, out of Columbia's library. He got a hold of the play material, said, I'm going to make this movie. He puts the whole movie together. It's inside the budget of the movie. Gets it all together. I don't even know about it. I'm not running the movie company. I'm running the corporation. And all of a sudden, I get a call. Rob Reiner wants to see. I said, you don't see me. You see, you got to go see John Dolgen. You know, you got to go see the head of the studio, or Mike Medavoy. Don't see me. I'm not making the movie decisions. So, no, I got to see. And I was his friend and everything. So I see him. He says, listen, we don't have the money to get the active Fugazi Man. I know you're familiar with the material. I hear the back. Remember, I heard the story about it. Yeah. I said, I want to throw them out of the office. Anybody comes in, they're only asking. You can hear the rattle of their begging cup when you come to my office. They're rattling that begging cup. You can hear it all the way. I'm just waiting for them to bring it out from behind their back. So he said, I need the money. I said, I need a really great actor to play the Colonel role in A Few Good Men. I said, yeah. He said, I want to go after Jack Nicholson. I know you made a bunch of films with Jack Nicholson. I want to go after him. I think we have a chance of getting him. But it's very expensive, like $5 million for 2 weeks' work. And I have been saying no to everything, and I don't make any decision or anything. It's everybody, because otherwise I'd be in trouble. I said, do it. With just two words, do it. I said, you got the money. You know, that's good. He says, why, you just say it that way? I said, King is good. I remember Mel Brooks said that. Do it, you know. And he went and got him, and he got the money and did it. So, you know, I think Jack Nicholson in that movie, you know, you want to hear the truth? Jack Nicholson in the movie, I'll tell you the truth. Jack Nicholson was a villain, and villains make movies successful. Villains are really, really important in movies. They're whether it's Anthony Hopkins or Jack Nicholson, when you're a good villain, man, that really makes the movie cook.
Wow, that's such a great story. But what the listeners of the podcast don't really know, and what you're too kind to say, is no one sits in that chair today like you and says, do it. They don't. What they do is they run it through marketing. They make a poster. They call Germany and see how much they can get from the Germans. And then they go, well, if we sell it to what's the Thailand would be and how would it do in China? And then they call, you know, and they put their finger in the wind and maybe they say do it. Maybe.
They don't say do it in the room. You're kind, but I'm sure they do it in a different way because it's a different time. But, you know, I came to that role as being a filmmaker. I came in that role that way. I didn't come in from marketing or from finance. I came in as a person that loved the métier of film and what it meant and what base it was for storytelling. But, you know, Rob, one of the things that's interesting to look at in decision-making, on projects. They're made by a collection of people. It's a truly collaborative art form. I'm sure you in your life, somebody says something to you, you're working hard on a project, and somebody just on the side who may be a set dresser or something will say, you know something? You know, I don't think you should wear the hat in this scene. Out of the clear blue sky. And you think, oh, that's crazy. And then you think, you take off the hat and you look, you do the scene. Wow, that was a good suggestion. You know, I mean, you have to be open to listen to it, but you must have to have a filter. You got both things. You can't just take everybody's suggestion, but you really have to be open to the ether to deliver things to you as an actor or a director or a storyteller that are useful. You know, it's a collaborative art form at the very heart.
When you said the key thing just now is you came into it as a lover of film and someone who'd been involved in storytelling and filmmaking and the nuts and bolts of it before you got into the big chair, as they say. Now it's a lot of Wall Street guys and people who come from business in other areas, and that's not necessarily a bad thing, but they're not there because they love movies. How they got there.
That may not be how they got there, and they may love movies and be there, and they may not love movies but love business, you know, but it is called show business. If it was just called show, they'd be all broke. If it was just called business, they'd be looking at budgets on the screen instead of actors and locations. So it is a blend of this. It is a commercial art form. And when you're spending upwards of $50, $100, $200 million on a movie, on a film, you have to, you know, leaven it because it can mean the demise of your entire company. So it does give you a little bit of sphincter arrest. You know what that is?
Yes.
It gives you a little bit. You know, it's like, so you think about it, you know, from a number of contextual realities. Will this sink the company? Will I be able to survive in it? But, you know, if you become risk averse and you're in the business of making films and making television and making stories, if you become risk averse, you know what you have? A flop.
What?
It's called a flop. When you become risk averse, there is risk built into every new and good and interesting film or television show. So if you're risk averse, you're really going to be in the hallways of film posters.
But listen, Peter, come on. Now you need to be honest with me right now. This is, you're in this business as much as anybody still. You can win all the basketball championships you want. You're still in the thick of it. You don't think that everybody today isn't risk averse? I think every decision. I don't mean to sound like I have any bitterness. I don't. I'm having a wonderful career and I love it. But dude, I gotta feel like everywhere you go to sell, you have to overcome the risk averse nature that permeates the buying world out there.
Yeah, it's a true statement. I see it. You know, and no is a 2-letter word. N-O. You know, and you hear that all the time, but I look at it, people like you and I, that we have to be dyslexic. We got to think no means on, and we just got to keep going. We just got to keep rolling, man. If you have the belief and conviction and have some tools and resources and resourcefulness, that you'll overcome that. So maybe those hurdles are there because the business is so much riskier now and everything is so much uncertain now that those things are there. But, you know, a really good script, a really good actor, a really good director, a really good entrepreneur, has to paddle in those waters. I mean, you buy into that. I think the real element is that films have taken a very dramatic turn. It's very, very difficult in the theatrical business, let alone all the theaters being closed right now, but it's very, very difficult in the theatrical business to make the kind of stories of Coming Home or Deer Hunter or, Being There, or Forrest Gump. You can't get those films made today, really. You just really, 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 really can't. The height of what you have and who the audience is that's going to theaters is very much defined by,
well,
let,
why,
by that.
Okay, why? I want to just do a quick deep dive on this because you just mentioned all movies that made me want to be an actor.
Yes.
You mentioned the movies that on a Friday as a kid, those were the choices. You get to go to a theater and see Being There. You get to go to theater, see The Deer Hunter, Coming Home. That it does not happen anymore. But why do people stop loving those movies? I can't imagine that happened.
No, but they're now 9 part series on television. Great writing on television. Great projects made all over the world. I mean, wonderful acting, fantastic directing. Wonderful. The format's different now. They're watching him on a giant screen in their 4-foot by 3-foot OLED screen, or they're watching it on one of these little phones like this. I mean, you make a $125 million movie, and there's a kid watching it on this. I mean, you're worrying about the art form, and they're watching on this, and they're listening to it live, and you worked so hard on the sound and so hard on the color and the texture, and they're looking at this while they're picking their nose, drinking a beer, patting their dog, and groping their girlfriend, all at the same time while you're competing for the movie. So the whole format has changed. The darkened theater, where people have appointment, go to the plan to go to the movie on Tuesday or Wednesday for Friday, they plan it in advance. All of that has changed. So we have to change our storytelling formats. And I think what's really happened is the power of narrative and of movie making has been transformed so that we have these unbelievable 5, 6, 7, 8 hour or 8-segment shows with the phenomenal writing and wonderful acting being done. I don't want to call it on television. It's on television, but it's on a screen other than a theatrical exhibition marketplace. So I'm compelled that that gives you the opportunity to reach them efficiently. And, the idea is I don't put gas in my car anymore. I just plug it into the wall. So I drive the car. It still gets me where I want to get to. So if I want to move people emotionally, if I want to be a filmmaker, a storyteller, a narrative person, a talk show person, do a podcast, if I want to move people to listen to me and follow into me, I have to be compelling inside the format I'm choosing. Inside that format. Normally, years ago, if we were to do something, it would be like this. It would be 30 seconds at the end of the news with you asking me one question. But now now you have this giant platform where you can talk for 45 minutes and not edit it and make it real life and have a whole different experience with it. So you have to surrender the past for what the future offers.
No, you're right. And it's true. The birth of the 8-hour limited series is where all the stuff that inspired me to be an actor lives now. And you see great work being done, all that. Basic Instinct. So that was like the thing that everybody talked about in that movie was that interrogation scene where you look up her skirt. Come on, as an actor. You don't know where the camera is? Come on. What say you, Peter Goober?
I'd say that narrative helped make the film successful.
Yes.
Not the shot. The narrative, not the shot. The shot was, if you really examine the shot, and we had to look at that shot 5 times for the MPAA and everything because, wasn't exposed, all those issues. But the issue, just as you framed it, became the dialogue that everybody talked about. That was the dialogue. Did she know? Didn't she know? What was it? What was it? Is it right? Is it wrong? That became the pinnacle of discussion around that. So everybody, in order to have a say in it, had to see it. See, that was the secret sauce. Not somebody made that up. It just happened that way. So the idea is sometimes, the interest of the public is piqued by an experience like that. And then people who would never go see that movie, I got to go see that movie because the water cooler, that's where people used to meet around. Yep. Everyone's talking about it. I don't want to be the dunce that didn't see it. You know what I mean? So the idea is, if I knew all the time what made success, what was the equation of success, I'd make hits. But I make hits and flops because I don't know that. I just hope that I catch the zeitgeist of the interest in the people and have the uniqueness that people want to talk about it, think about it, and communicate to others about the show or film so they go see it. In that particular film, that was the thing. I mean, Michael Douglas did a really good performance. He was really good in it. But at the end of the day, that became the voice. That's my wife yelling at me.
That is Hillary Clinton calling in.
Yes, right. It's the voice of doom. So,
well, listen. Thank you for doing this. I adore you. I love you so much, man. And to be able to bring some of your wisdom and just your worldview to people. This has been maybe my favorite podcast because of that, because I'm lucky. I get to know you, and now everybody else gets a little bit of some of that Peter Goober goodness.
I only got one thing to say to you in closing. You know what it is?
What?
You know what that is?
No.
The seal in Machu Picchu and the Galapagos.
Peter Guber and I went to the Galapagos together and were attacked by all kinds of animals. But that is for a whole... We got to do our Mutual Omaha's Wild Kingdom. You can be Marlon Perkins.
Right. Upriver. Right.
Yeah. All right, my brother.
All right. Be well.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye. Wow. So inspiring. It's, you know what? I think as guys, I'll speak for myself. It's hard to have mentors. People don't, you know, we don't sometimes as men share with each other and open up to each other and pick each other's brains. Yeah, we have our fathers and things and we have our friends, but like it's to have for me to have a mentor like Peter Guber is such an amazing gift. And I'm just reminded of it listening to that conversation, some of which I've heard before from him, but to be able to share that with you guys just makes me so happy. And, you know, I mean, he's going to be 80 years old soon. And listen to him. Like that heart and that spirit, he's not jaded. He's not tired. He's curious. Doesn't claim to have all the answers. Really, really, really inspiring. And I'm glad that you joined me. And I'll see you next time.
You have been listening to Literally with Rob Lowe. Produced by Devontory Bryant and Delina Turman. Engineered by me, Devontory Bryant. Executive produced by Rob Lowe for Low Profile. Adam Sachs and Jeff Ross at Team Coco. And Colin Anderson and Chris Bannon at Stitcher. The supervising producer is Aaron Blaert. Talent producer, Jennifer Samples. Please rate and review this show on Apple Podcasts. And remember to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This has been a Team Coco production in association with Stitcher.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.